committee and myself. Next transparency, please. So 3 weeks ago, I already spent 10 minutes giving this introduction, so I think this time I can just very quickly pass through the main points of the introduction. So quantum gravity is within reach. It consists of two frameworks. The first framework one can call relational Dirac observables. Due to this framework, we understand how spacetime, physical spacetime, emerges from relations between fields. Next transparency, please. And especially a powerful example of this framework is so-called deparametrization technique. The second framework, which is needed to complete this first one, is some framework which will provide quantum operators, Hilbert spaces, and states. So loop quantum gravity is the first framework known of this type. So we apply loop quantum gravity and combine loop quantum gravity with the relational observables framework to achieve complete theory of quantum gravity. Okay, one could think, so we are now on next page, transparency number 4. So one could think that quantum gravity is the last missing chain of quantum theory of everything. In fact, this is the other way around. Quantum gravity actually opens the door to new theory. However, we need to reintroduce all the other fields together with, in a way consistent with quantum gravity, to obtain a new theory. Therefore, we proceed step by step. We start with the simplest possible cases, and then we learn how to switch on the other degrees of freedom. So for next transparency, number 5. So for this reason, for a long time, we have been studying, and we are still studying the symmetry reduced models. And we learn a lot from them about quantum possible structures emerging from and phenomena emerging from quantum gravity. Next transparency, please. And now we have already one complete model of quantum gravity. This model was introduced by Giesel and Kiemann, who applied loop quantum gravity techniques to the Brown-Kuchar model. And in the current paper I'm reporting on today, we applied loop quantum gravity to the model introduced by Rovelli and Smalley. And the classical canonical structure of this model was studied also in a paper by Kuchar and Romano. This model of gravity comes from a theory of gravity coupled to a massless scalar field. And our goal is to complete this construction with the tools of loop quantum gravity. Next transparency. Okay, so here is the plan of my talk. In the first part, I will discuss the formal structure of the quantum model. We will derive the general solution to the quantum constraints. We will derive the general Dirac observable, introduce dynamics, and explain how a Hilbert structure can be defined. However, we will not worry about details, whether those, we will not construct those operators. We will be just assuming that operators we need exist and they have all the properties which we are using. And the goal of this first part is come to a conclusion, which is the list of mathematical elements which are necessary for such model to exist and to be constructed. Then in the third part, I will explain how loop quantum gravity framework provides those elements which are necessary for those mathematical structures which emerge from the first part, and how we can actually accomplish all this construction. Okay, then I'll go to the next transparency, number 8. So can you hear me, by the way? Jorge?
Yes, you hear okay. Very well.
Thank you very much. Okay, so this transparency should be understood as actually an introduction of the model which I will be discussing. So this is a canonical, so the classical counterpart of this model consists of, is defined as canonical framework defined by a metric tensor QAB, the conjugate momentum PAB, and the scalar field phi and the conjugate momentum phi. They satisfy the canonical Poisson bracket. Later, we will switch to the Ashtekar-Barbero variables, but this part is general enough to even to be dealt with the usual ADM variables. This is the only reason why I'm using QAB and PAB. Okay, so the standard that the Einstein's gravity couples to the scalar field, to the massless scalar field, is described by the constraints 2 and 3. So the constraint number 2 is, I mean the equation number 2 gives you the scalar constraint. And the equation number 3 is the formula for the vector constraint. Okay, however, this is not exactly the model we will be considering. The model which we will be considering can be defined in the following way. Let us solve the constraint for the momentum conjugate to the scalar field, for the scalar field momentum. And in this way, let us define a new scalar constraint P prime, which is numbered by, which is equation number 4. Okay, this with small h defined by 5. So this constraint is equivalent to the original scalar constraint together with, so if we replace the scalar constraint by this p prime constraint and still take the vector constraint, then the resulting theory is equivalent to the previous one on some open region in the phase space. This open region contains the Friedman-Robertson-Walker solution with the scalar field. So, however, we at this point we forget about the other regions in phase space. We are just assuming this is our theory, and this is theory whose quantum counterpart we will be looking for. Okay, can I go on the, or does anybody want to ask a question? Abai sent me a message that I should very clearly explain why do I switch from scalar constraint 2 to scalar constraint 4. I understand there are no.
So you're okay. Doing because of, in particular, because of equation 7, right?
Once again?
So the statement is that the system is still first class. And when you say that the Poisson bracket is equal to 0, you mean it is weakly 0, it's not strongly 0.
So actually those Poisson brackets, they are strongly 0. And this is one of nice technical features of those new constraints. This is what was discussed in detail in that paper by Kuhar and Romano.
Yeah, so that's what I was referring to explain that, yeah.
Right. So in particular, even if there was no scalar field, one could still consider the quality 5 to as a replacement for the usual scalar constraint for gravitational field, and then those scalar constraints, new scalar constraints, they strongly commute, which might be convenient even for vacuum gravity if one wanted to do it. Okay, so let's go to the next transparency. Okay. So, still on this classical level, just let me recall that Dirac observable is a function of QP, phi, and phi. However, this function cannot be arbitrary. This function has to Poisson commute with the constraint. And in our case, the Poisson commuting with the vector constraint means invariance with respect to the local diffeomorphisms of the underlying manifold M. And commuting with the scalar constraint is more difficult to explain geometrically, other than this is a invariance with respect to time evolution in direction of orthonormal to the Cauchy term. And however, one more important element of this definition of the Dirac observable is that actually the only thing what matters is the restriction of this function to the constraint surface. And then the algebra of those functions defines the algebra of the Dirac observable. Okay, let us go on to the next transparency. So this transparency just introduces the quantum structure of the quantum state and quantum constraints. So here we use the usual Schrödinger-like representation in which space, quantum space are functions of position variables, and for the position variables we promote the scalar field phi and the metric tensor q. And quantum field operators are just either multiplication by the field or functional derivative in the case of the conjugate momentum. Now we have to implement the quantum constraint. And the vector constraint is just implemented as a requirement of the diffeomorphism invariance. The invariance with respect to diffeomorphism of the three-dimensional manifold M. Whereas the scalar constraint, but this new deparametrized scalar constraint, has to be defined. The first term is the momentum operator, so it has been already defined, and the second term has yet to be defined. Here I will be assuming that I'm just given this operator and I can be using it. And then this constraint just reads that the state has to be annihilated, physical state has to be annihilated by the operator T prime. And there is still that consistency condition that the we still have a lowercase h operator labeled by a point x of manifold. So at the different points, the operators have to commute. This is a consistency condition. We may consider this as a lack of anomaly. Okay, let us go on to the next transparency. So on this transparency, I just derive a general solution to the quantum constraint. It turns out that in this case, it's pretty easy to derive exactly a general solution. So equation number 13 is the scalar constraint, the deparametrized scalar constraint. Equation number 14 is the trick which we use, namely we write the function in this peculiar form and then plug it in the constraint. And then the constraint is telling us that a general solution to the deparametrized scalar constraint is given by equation 15. Moreover, the vector constraint, which amounts to the diffeomorphism invariant, now is solved just by the diffeomorphism invariance of this new function lowercase psi, which is only a function of, which doesn't depend any longer on the scalar field, it depends only on the metric tensor. So this is a general solution to the quantum constraint given by equation 15 and by the condition 16. Okay, now let's move on to transparency number 12. So this transparency will give us a general solution to the conditions on quantum Dirac observable. So in the quantum theory, a quantum Dirac observable is given by the restriction to the space of solutions to the constraint of an operator which satisfies the following property. In this case, for those constraints, this operator is diffeomorphism invariant and it commutes with the deparametrized scalar constraint. And now it turns out that, again, it's quite easy to derive a general solution to those conditions. So suppose that operator O is a Dirac observable, then we write it in the form 17 with some arbitrary operator L inside. And then if we impose the constraint, then from the scalar constraint, this is the parameterized scalar constraint, we learn that the new operator L has to be commuting with pi. And this is it. So we find the generators in the space of solutions to this condition. One class of generators is just pi itself, and the second class are all the operators L which don't involve the scalar field at all. That is, they map functions defined on the space of metric tensors into functions defined on the space of metric tensors. Okay, and now what we do is we use again this form 17 to calculate a Dirac observable out of a given generator. So now if we use the generator pi, then we will see that it gives us just the scalar constraint. So it is identically zero when reduced to the solution. So we are left with the solutions of the type 2. And the diffeomorphism invariant amounts to the condition that the operator L is diffeomorphism invariant. So the outline of this solution is given on the next transparency, number 13. So the statement is that a general Dirac observable is defined on the solutions on a general solution to the constraints in the way described by equation 20 and 21. And moreover, those observables form an algebra. So product of two observables labeled by operators L and L prime is an observable labeled by the product, assuming that we can really indeed take products and we can multiply those operators, which is the case if we assume that all the operators are bounded. Okay, so we have all the solutions to the quantum constraints and we have all the Dirac observables. We can now go on to the next transparency, number 13. Okay, so as you could see, I didn't have to use any classical framework to introduce those observables. However, we can interpret those observables in terms of the canonical framework. And this is how this relational observable framework now shows up. So it turns out that our observables can be understood in the following way. So suppose that the operator L, which was used on the previous transparency to define a Dirac observable, actually corresponds to a classical function which is defined on the gravitational degrees of freedom. And it has support in this part of phase space, which is actually the phase space for our model. Then, briefly speaking, given a point, suppose that it can be gauge transformed to another point such that phi is zero. So equation number 25 gives you a composition of maps which define this new function. So given a point, we first go to another point by gauge transforming phi to zero, and then we evaluate the function L at this point. And the composition of those two maps defines this new function, and that new function is exactly the classical function corresponding to the Dirac operator, which we have already assigned to this operator L on the previous transparency. So this transparency gives us the classical interpretation in the case if this construction can really, if this construction exists, it means if we really can gauge transform phi to zero. But if we cannot, then still the quantum observables exist. It just means that there is some difference between quantum theory and the original classical theory. Okay, so this classical interpretation will also give us a clue how to define a dynamical evolution in the space of Dirac observables. Let us go to the next transparency. Okay, so now, whereas the solution to the constraint was actually, the solutions were derived, we didn't put by hand anything, and the Dirac observables were also derived, we found them all. And now, in order to define this one-dimensional group of dynamical evolutions, we actually have to make some choice. So the choice consists in finding a one-dimensional group of automorphisms defined in this algebra of the Dirac observable. So in this case, it's easy to show an example of such group of automorphisms, and then we can promote this group to the time evolution. However, there is no proof that this is the only possibility. One could find perhaps a different one-dimensional group. So in this case, to begin with, we can see in equation 26 that actually every function phi zero can be used to map one Dirac observable to another operator, which commutes with the scalar constraint. However, in order to obtain again a diffeomorphic invariant operator, we have to assume that phi zero is constant, because only then the new operator will be still the Dirac observable. So the conclusion is that every constant function phi zero defines a map from the algebra of Dirac observables to the algebra of the Dirac observable. Therefore, we can consider this as this one-dimensional group of automorphisms. So we can calculate the generator of those automorphisms in equation 27 and promote the generator to the physical Hamiltonian. In fact, this generator is the integral of the operator which already appears in formulae 26 and in previous formulas. So in this way, this physical Hamiltonian is derived from this group of automorphisms. Okay, let us go on to the transparency number 16. So now let us briefly discuss the physical Hamiltonian, what it consists of. So this Hamiltonian should be derived as having in mind the classical form it takes. So here in equation 29, I just rewrote the classical formula, replacing, just adding head upon the expression. So at some point we have to construct the operator like this. However, there is one remark that it's conceivable that our operator in fact has a simpler form. Namely,
can I ask you something, Jurek, here? This is again about form 29, which came from classical theory, right?
Yes.
So the way that you had defined the classical C hat GR, I think you wanted it to be a density of weight 1. But since you are going to be multiplying everywhere by square root of Q, so it seems to me that the gravitational Hamiltonian that you are really using, I mean, or either square root of Q times C hat that you are using, is really density of weight 2. Right? And then you are taking its square root.
At the end of the game, the final square root is the density of weight 1.
Right. So then how does it work? So if I look at... So my point is just the following, right? I mean, my point is just that you could have just used the Hamiltonian, gravitational Hamiltonian of density weight 2 from the beginning, right? Then you would not have these awkward factors of square root of Q everywhere.
Okay.
You agree with that, right? I mean, the reason I'm saying is because of all these parameterized field theories and so on, they are now telling us that it is easier or it is more likely or what it is better to use the Hamiltonian constant of density weight 2.
Yes, this is the way some people understand those results. But in order to construct a strongly Poisson commuting expression, somehow using densities of weight 2 is helped.
And you are also using that, is my point of view. And is that not right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
This is Carlo from you refer to our works in 93, and that was an aspect by analyzing that. Later you write in equation 30, in fact, going to the quantum series will define identity. So the keeping track of the density character was our main motivation in 93 to get to equation 30. And to promote it to the quantum theory then.
I didn't hear you well, but I understand that you are explaining in your way how we derive the meaning of this formula, yes?
Yes, I fully agree with everything you say.
Okay, thank you. This I understood. Okay, thank you. Okay, fine. So if I can go on. And now... we can see that in equation 29, under the square root, we have generators, we have only gravitational expressions which involve gravitational operators. And those we have both the generators of the vector constraint and generators of the scalar constraint. So depending on how we order we have this ordering ambiguity, so depending what order we choose, there is ambiguity in defining this expression. However, if we optimistically use the simplest, from this point of view, order such that all the generators of the geomorphism go to the right, then when we apply this, and also remember that this operator is applied to the geomorphism invariant state, then actually it's the same as setting all the vector constraints to zero and using instead expression number 30. And remarkably, this is exactly the form of the physical Hamiltonian which was given by Rovelli and Smolin in their model, which was derived in a different way by first fixing the gauge classically and then doing this formal quantization. But the result is the same. And I like this form very much because it is much simpler than 29. Okay, so if you let me go, I would like to go to transparency number 17. And one more remark on this formal level. That actually it's not so difficult to define the physical scalar product between the physical solutions, provided we have a suitable scalar product between functions defined on the space of metric tensors, which are diffeomorphism invariant. So suppose that we have Hilbert space, which consists of diffeomorphism invariant functionals on the space of metric tensors, and there is scalar product, then equation 33 is showing you how we can define the physical scalar product by using this auxiliary scalar the scalar product in the space of diffeomorphism invariant functional. So that shows that gives us a clue what kind of structure we should be looking for. We should try to construct in order to achieve this physical Hilbert. Okay, so let us summarize our observations in the next transparency. So the exact structures we need are the following. We need a Hilbert space of diffeomorphism invariant functionals defined on gravitational degrees of freedom, so functions on space of symmetry tensors. Well, in fact, they will be kind of distributions, but we'll come back to this point in two transparencies later. We need operators in this Hilbert space which represent some geometric quantities we understand, like, for instance, the volume of total volume operator or some total scalar curvature, this kind of operator. And we need a Hamiltonian operator. Finally, at some point, we have to define this operator specifically. We have to define its action. And while defining this operator, we have to remember that actually it comes as the integral along the underlying manifold of operators assigned to points of manifold. And then those operators, they should somehow remember that they are coming from square root of this product of metric determinants and scalar constraints. And actually, this is a difficult technical problem, because to define square root, you need self-adjoint operator. On the other hand, those operators cannot by any way preserve this Hilbert space of diffeomorphism invariant functions, because they break the diffeomorphism invariant. So it's clear that we will need some more Hilbert spaces. And so we will need also some Hilbert spaces assigned to points of our manifold. And on the top of this, we also have this last condition, that commutator of two operators in H, two different points, has to be zero. So we still need some framework to combine operators defined in different Hilbert spaces and to define the commutator, make sure it is zero, and make sure that this is the commutator which actually is relevant for our construction. So it is all the more remarkable that all those structures actually either have been constructed or are easy to be constructed within the loop quantum gravity. And this is the main message of the remaining part of the talk. So now I will switch gears. So if there are any questions about this first formal part, this is a good point to ask those questions. And if not, then I will go on. Let us go to transparency number 90. Okay, so let me briefly sketch how we achieve this second paradigm, how we define our quantum operator. Okay, so as I mentioned, instead of using the ADM variables, we use the Ashtekar-Barbero variables. So our variables Q and P are in fact A, capital A, and capital P. And A is the Ashtekar-Barbero connection. P is the conjugate momentum, which formally has the form of non-abelian electric field. And those equations 36 gives you the relation between the Ashtekar-Barbero variables and the extrinsic curvature K and orthonormal frame E. And the Poisson brackets 37 are just the canonical Poisson brackets. Okay, so these are the classical Ashtekar-Barbero variables which we use in loop quantum gravity. Now, let's go to the next transparency. And now, using the connection variables, we define those variables which will be relevant in the passage from the classical theory to the quantum theory. So So we are assuming that those elementary variables, which will be exactly quantized, so it means which will be quantized without any ambiguity, are the holonomies of the Ashtekar-Barbera connection along curve denoted by E, and fluxes of the conjugate momentum along some two surfaces S, and integrated against some smearing function S. Those holonomies and fluxes, they define, they have a nice Poisson bracket, and quantization of this Poisson bracket, it means replacing this Poisson bracket by the quantum commutator, gives rise to abstractly defined quantum holonomy flux star algebra. And now the aim of quantization boils down to constructing diffeomorphism covariant representations of this holonomy flux star algebra. And here is a good message that actually on this holonomy flux star algebra there exists a unique diffeomorphism invariant state. So the GNS construction with the state defines the quantum representation for this algebra. In this representation, the holonomies and fluxes become operators. And this is actually the representation which is underlying for all the loop quantum gravity. With the Hilbert space, which comes with this representation, is used as the kinematical Hilbert space. By using this Hilbert space and some functional distribution in this Hilbert space, we define all the other Hilbert spaces and all the other operators we need. So let's go on to the next transparency. Okay, so now let me just give you a brief sketch how we introduce those eventual Hilbert spaces. So as I pointed out, those operators which H, which after integration give them a physical Hamiltonian, each of them needs its own Hilbert space of states which are invariant with respect to all the diffeomorphisms preserving a given point X of the manifold. So actually there is a nice elegant construction of such Hilbert space which uses a ridging map. The ridging map may be thought of morally as integration with respect to the diffeomorphisms preserving point X. And actually, I would say this integration, but defined in a suitable way, such that it gives a finite result. And this integration, this ridging map, maps a normalizable state of kinematical from kinematical Hilbert space, however, not all of them, but just from some suitable domain, into distributions, which are now invariant. So 39 gives you structure of this map, and the right hand side of 39 is this distribution, and this distribution is invariant with respect to diffeomorphism preserving the point X. Those distributions are not normalizable any longer. However, we can define for them a new scalar product with equation 40. And with those distributions, with this new scalar product, they define a Hilbert space. And this Hilbert space is the natural Hilbert space for those operator components of the physical Hamiltonian. So in this Hilbert space consisting of those distributions, we can next define this square root of determinant times the gravitational constraint. And we can do this by using the loop quantum gravity framework. We have all the operators, or we know how to define the corresponding operators. We know how to define the scalar constraint operator, how to define the square root of metric determinant operator. They are the structure of those operators is in equation 41. And for such operators, it's suitable regularization gives operators of the form 42. So we know how to, it's easy to find a way to multiply those operators and take the square root. Modulo ordering ambiguities, which should be fixed in such a way that the expression under the square root is self-adjoint. So for this reason, we have to somehow symmetrize the scalar constraint, and we also have to symmetrize the product. So this scalar... Yes?
So the reason you drop the diffeomorphism constraints in the square root, equation 29?
Yes.
Because you are going to use diffeomorphism invariant states, but now you are not using states which are diffeomorphism invariant.
Okay, maybe there is maybe there is something in your remark. I don't know, but somehow once I drop this, I deal with this operator with dropped generators, and now I try to define that operator. So that's why I don't bother any longer about those. But I understand your point. I don't know. Maybe you are right that maybe one has to keep track of those generators of the vector constraint.
Yeah, you have to, unless you show that you don't have to. I mean, you have to do something, right? You have to argue that this is okay.
Yes, my goal is to define that integrated operator on the space of diffeomorphism invariant state. But... yes, but somehow I need also to define the square root for this. I need those auxiliary Hilbert spaces. So I don't know whether or not I should again remember where this operator is coming from. And maybe you're right. I don't know. It is reasonable also to just to deal with this operator with dropped vector constraints. Okay, so if we do it like this, then we actually have a specific proposal. So this equation 42 is actually giving you specific proposal for this operator H at point X, and the operators which are used here can be either found in the literature of loop quantum gravity or can be constructed by suitable symmetrization, because this operator capital C, this constraint operator, it has to be symmetrized. It has to be symmetrized with respect to the scalar, to the Hilbert scalar product. So it cannot be just annihilating loops. It has to be both annihilating and adding. Okay. However, it turns out that this operator can be defined even in simpler way if we go to the next transparency, number 22, and if we consider to begin with the Euclidean version of the theorem. So in the Euclidean version, this operator, which is square rooted, actually has the original form of the Ashtekar constraint. Namely, it is just quadratic in the conjugate momenta P and linear in F. So for this type of operator, there is we can just directly find quantum counterpart of this operator without using the in fact more complicated and more difficult operators which were on the previous transparency. So this operator can be just quantized by itself. We don't need the T-man trig. It doesn't mean that there is something wrong with the T-man trig, but it means that T-man trig is very, very sophisticated, which in this case, even we don't have to use because it is much easier, because the example is much easier. And in fact, there was introduced some framework how to check the commutation relations between operators like operator 43, and according to the results which we derived with Don Morrow, at least the equation as the operator 43, they commute for a nice choice of loops which we attach. So in the definition of this operator, there's ambiguity consisting in replacing the curvature by attached loop. And then this loop can be attached in many different ways, but if we choose some simple way such that it doesn't create new vertices which are not flat, then which are not planar, then according to our previous results, the operators 43, they commute in different points. There is still a technical problem to show that if those operators commute, that also the square roots commute. This involves self-adjoint extensions and some technical work which has to be done. But there is a framework for this, and there is a good chance that we can also show this. So it seems that the issue of
the operator 43 that you defined, may not have worried about self-adjoint extension, but you took a symmetric operator. Is that true?
Yes. So we have to take for this. So here I wrote the classical expression, and yeah. Now when we take the operator, quantum operator, it has to be symmetrized.
Great. So that's very nice. So you've got a symmetric operator, and this commutation 44 is really the reflection of the Poinsot bracket that you had, that h of x and h of y Poinsot commute. In the classical theory that you began with. So it's very nice that the classical Poinsot bracket was a guideline. You did not just want to introduce that the commutator is zero for some abstract reason. It was nicely motivated from the classical theory.
Yes. So in the classical theory, this is just the case. And on the other hand, it was also this relation was also used in the derivation of the general solution to the constraints and in the derivation of the Dirac observable. So it better be also satisfied for the consistency. Okay, so this is it. We can go to the last transparency. So the message is that we have the number of complete models of quantum gravity is growing. We have at least two models, and it's easy to construct other models in similar way. Especially this model is may be considered as a generalization of loop quantum cosmology to the full set of degrees of freedom. Within this model, we can consider the Big Bang with all the gravitational degrees of freedom. We can also check if there is a Hawking evaporation of gravitational degrees of freedom. I don't think that this model incorporates the scalar field degrees of freedom, which are used in the Hawking argument. However, certainly we can check if the gravitational degrees of freedom are subject to Hawking evaporation. And this model is very technical, which will be understood only for people who are familiar very well with quantum gravity. That in this first model in the literature by Thomas and Christina, actually every graph is preserved by the dynamics. So somehow conclusion is that maybe we all live in a fixed lattice. In this case, in the case of our model, it is not the case. In the case of our model, those graphs are not preserved by dynamics, so we still need all of them. So it looks more like the traditional quantum gravity as opposed to the algebraic quantum gravity as Thomas and Christina named in their model. Okay, next transparency, the really last one. I want to thank people who already discussed with me and contributed to this subject, and then after this talk I will probably have to extend the list of people who I want to thank. And thank you everybody for listening.
questions? Was that a question?
No, it's not a question.
Okay, so if nobody has a question, I have a couple. One is the following, that, on the one hand, as you say, this can be thought of as being... Can people hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so on the one hand, one can think of this as being an extension, for example, of loop quantum cosmology, and because there, in fact, all the steps that you talk about, including the way that constraint is actually treated, are carried out. Okay, so in other words, the Hamiltonian constraint is solved exactly the way that you are solving it here.
Okay. Right.
So that's very nice. But it's not clear to me that in the black hole case, if I look at just classically, these ideas go through for a black hole that is formed of a scalar collapse. So what one would have to consider is the following. In the loop quantum cosmology case, one can just look at the Friedman model, and there one knows that scalar field is good time, phi equal to constant, give us nice surfaces, foliation of space-time globally in space-time, and everything is fine. So I would have to check that that is the case also for the classical solution corresponding to the gravitational collapse of a spherical symmetric gravitational collapse of a scalar field. Unless that is done, I don't think one can say that this whole thing is applicable to a neighborhood of the Schwarzschild, of the collapsing black hole space-time. If in fact it is true, then I agree that this is a very nice way of actually trying to probe what happens to the Hawking effect. But I think there is an important check to be done just at the classical level. And my second remark is that if I go back to the analogy with loop quantum cosmology, then there the Hamiltonian constraint had, in order to have something which is viable, physically viable, one had to use, so to say, this improved dynamics. That improved dynamics has the Hamiltonian constraint you have, so to say, knows about the state on which it is acting in a non-trivial fashion. You know, that is to say, this mu bar parameter is actually a function. It's not a constant, but it's actually a function of the state on which the Hamiltonian is actually acting. This parameterized field theory people are also finding results which are in very much synergy with what you are saying. Namely, as I mentioned earlier, they also think that if one actually look at the density two-weight Hamiltonian constraint, then one can actually have a nice interplay between what happens in quantum theory and what happens to the constraint algebra in the classical theory. So there is a very nice interplay. But they also find that in order to do this, the Hamiltonian constraint that they have to use has density weight kind of two form, but also it has elements of this improved dynamics in it. And this they find is being quite important. So my question is, when Don and you tried to do this H of X operator, did it have any elements that go beyond the elements that were used by in the Thiemann construction? The new edge that you attach to the graph in Thiemann construction, one just says that, well, that has some spin 1/2, which doesn't depend on what state you are acting on. But this improved dynamics suggests that, in fact, your construction, like the spin that you will attach, might actually depend on the state on which you are acting on and so on. So were there any hints in what you did in defining H of X operator with Don, which actually suggested that there were hints of this improved dynamics kind of operator?
No. So actually, those days when we were considering those operators, we didn't think of this improved dynamics. So but of course, these days when we have this new results from loop quantum cosmology, we can try to understand to also formulate them in the full theory. But previously we didn't see such. And going back to the first question of the black holes, yes, I agree that in order to really have a black hole to talk about black holes, we should see if this model contains black holes in the semi-classical regime. And if it doesn't, then of course this model is not good for all the gravity in especially for black holes, because we know that black holes exist. So we should check if the semi-classical solution of this model, if they contain also if they describe black holes.
Thank you. I do think that looking at both these questions are very important. I think it'll be good to look at them. First, the first question is just classical, but the second question also, I think, there seems to be convergence coming from various ideas, loop quantum cosmology, parameterized field theories, and so on. So it'll be good to see how to define this operator HFX in your framework, which somehow incorporates some elements that make it viable as a physical model, right? In other words, you want to get a bounce, but you don't want to get a bounce at the density of water and such things. And this actually is very nice, because one could actually probe these issues in this more general model that you have. Thank you.
More questions? Okay, so no more questions. Okay, thank you, Jurek.
Again, not just for Jurek, but maybe for all the whole community, which is really the following. I think it is a very nice idea to do this kind of conversation, which I was in the early days opposed to this, namely just look at a class of, subset of phase space on which some gauge conditions hold, on which there is some nice structure, on which one can have a notion of time, like given by the scalar field or something like that. But I think this is a very good idea to look at this part of the phase space and do quantum theory. But then there is a very important question, namely, what this quantum theory then, as Jurek has said, has predictions. For example, there are Dirac observables also in the regime where these assumptions for the classical phase space fail. So we got more general objects which are no classical analogs at all. It's not that it's bad or anything, but we have to understand that. Right? So we have to understand the fact that classically, in order to make the Hamiltonian framework meaningful, we are restricting ourselves to some part of phase space, making some assumptions about it. But quantum mechanically, we seem to get a theory which does not have such restrictions. We just get a theory. And so the question is whether this theory then would have ridiculous semi-classical limits, or in fact it is a nice extension of classical ideas. So I think that somehow we have to decide between these two possibilities. It's not going to be one or the other, but where are we in between? So this to me is a conceptual challenge, not just to Jurek, but to everybody thinking about these problems.
More questions?
Yes, so I can add a comment to this, that even in within loop quantum cosmology, when we consider the case with positive scalar curvature, with positive cosmological constants, then indeed this is what happens, that some of those Dirac observables which I defined here would not be well defined classically. However, they are well defined in quantum model, and they just involve more structure, which is given by choice of self-adjoint extension of the operators we use. So those operators, they emerge as not uniquely self-adjoint. So we have freedom in choosing self-adjointness. And then, so classical theory doesn't fix this completely. Quantum theory, we have different choices for self-adjoint extension, and different choices give us different extensions of the classical theory. So we can also expect similar effects here, that in some cases when classically that this gauge choice doesn't exist, which we are assuming, it will mean in the quantum theory that some of this physical Hamiltonian is not self-adjoint, that we have to decide what self-adjoint extension we use, and then this self-adjoint extension will be telling us how to extend the evolution behind the classical, the classically defined trajectory.
Yeah, thank you. This is a very, very, very nice example, because in this example, then one sees physically what is happening, and it really is that quantum theory is giving us certain extension, provided we give additional information, namely self-adjoint, which self-adjoint extension you choose. So here, I think we can understand physics very well, and so it will be nice to, I mean, we'll, let's hope that it's also true much more generally. Thank you very much for this example.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that actually this example comes from Abai's paper.
Jurek, this is Carlo.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I don't hear you ideally, but I can recognize that you are Carlo.
I'm confused about self-adjoint extension. The reason you don't cover the entire phase space, it's very simple. It's because your scalar field is finding a time which is not a good time that can come back. So this phenomenon started in the finite dimensional model, and like simply a system in which the solution, the trajectory in extended configuration space are compact, for example, like two harmonic oscillators with energy. In that case, I don't think we have to make a self-adjoint generator with respect to the evolution of one of the variables. We just have to live with the fact that this evolution is not unitary, and so you can use the evolution, but you have to expect to inheriting that evolution, which means simply that nothing is going wrong physically, only that we are using the appropriate independent variables in some regime. So do we really have to complete the quantum theory and suppose H to be self-adjoint, or we just have to complete it and use a different modeling when we go in the region to the corresponding time is not a good time? Do I make sense?
Yes, so I don't think that this self-adjointness is actually solves all the problems, but this is just the first thing which breaks in the quantum theory in case when we when classical evolution stops earlier than we would like, when it stops some finite value of time. So now I agree that in the case of scalar field with potential, we don't know how to use the scalar field as clock and or something else. But I don't think that this is a good idea to be, in general, that this is a good attitude to be using the classical theory as fundamental and trying to cover it with chart of classical theory, of quantum theories. I agree that the classical theory is something what we should, what should come from the experiment. So, for instance, if this is electromagnetic field, then we can rely on this classical theory because we can measure electromagnetic field and we know that it really exists. However, in the case of some other fields which we don't directly measure, then I think it is up to, we have some freedom in defining this quantum model, and as long as it agrees with the world which we can see, then we shouldn't worry about the classical theories and the classical phase space. We should derive the classical theory as secondary framework from the quantum theory, not the other way around.
Yeah, I agree with you, Gurek, but I think Carlo was raising a slightly different question, and I think his question was whether we have to worry about self-adjointness, or we can just say that you just take some self-adjoint extension and work with it. But so technically, one just has to choose some self-adjoint extension, because if you don't do that, then you don't have a theory. And then we have to understand the meaning of the self-adjoint extension. But the statement is that there will be cases where, as in the case of the two harmonic oscillators whose energy, some of the energy is fixed, in that case, there is no global time variable, and you just have to do evolution in local times, and that will be perfectly fine here. But there will be other cases, such as the cosmological constant positive case that one was talking about, where the statement would be that, in fact, very meaningful extension exists beyond what the classical theory tells us, and therefore we can take this extension. So there are many different aspects, that many different results that can come out of this whole analysis, some of which will capture the cosmological constant situation, some of which will capture the sum of the energies, the two harmonic oscillator with some constraint, that system. And there will be many others also. But Jurek, the possibility is also that it's true that we should not focus on classical theory. We should look at quantum theory and then come down. But it is also possible, as happened to quantum cosmology first, that this quantum theory gives us some ridiculous results, physically ridiculous results. And that's what one has to sort of check. And one check of that is confrontation with the classical theory. So wherever there is kind of disparity between classical theory and this quantum theory, then we have to go and check whether what we are getting is physically reasonable.
Right.
Yes, it's Carl again. I think I agree entirely, and I think that you made is important. We exit the region from space in which this system is well defined just because of the choice of variables. And there is another case in which we expect to bring out the validity of the classical theory. And this, so we should keep them distinct. Point, yes.
More questions? Okay, let's thank you, Rick, again.